Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Amateur Traveler, episode 722. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about Seljuks and Parthians and Mongols, a wedding palace, caravan sarais, and a flaming crater as we go to Turkmenistan. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Let's talk about Turkmenistan. I'd like to welcome back to the show Justin Barnes from justinandcrystal.com. And Justin has come to talk to us about Turkmenistan. Justin, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me back.
And I say welcome back to the show. Justin was on episode 629 about the Big Island of Hawaii. This is a very different destination we're talking about today. What's your connection with Turkmenistan?
We traveled there on a trip to four of the five stands. There's the five stands: Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, and Kyrgyzstan. And we went to four of them on a trip. And Turkmenistan is certainly the most interesting of the bunch in terms of how foreign it was. I mean, it epitomizes foreign in every sense of the word.
Well, and I was very interested in doing the show because it's been a long time since we've talked about Turkmenistan, and also because before COVID hit, we had a amateur traveler trip planned to the stands, not to all five, to two, I think, of them, as I recall, in 2021, which has bumped to 2022, but still planning on taking a group to that region of the world. So why should someone go to Turkmenistan?
Well, for one thing, it has something that I'm fairly certain no other country in the world has, which is a giant flaming pit in the middle of the desert that looks, for all intents and purposes, like a volcanic crater, but is actually just burning natural gas, and you can walk right up to the edge of it. It's about a football field across and about 100 feet deep, and that's something you're not going to see anywhere else in the world.
I think Azerbaijan has some similar geologic features of natural burning areas that have been burning for hundreds of years.
Well, in addition to that, there's some very interesting Silk Road historical sites and also some history even older than that, going back to Parthian times and earlier.
Excellent. And the Parthians being contemporaries with and rivals with the Romans.
Yes.
The recreation of the Persian state after the fall of Persia to Alexander the Great.
Exactly.
Excellent. Well, what should one do in Turkmenistan? Where are you going to take us on an itinerary here?
So I would recommend four main sites that can kind of be seen in any order. One is the capital, Ashgabat, which is in the south central part of the country. Another one is the Darbaza gas crater, which is more or less in the very center of the country. Then Konya Urganch, which is in the north central part of the country. And then finally Merv, which is in the eastern part of the country. And the order in which you would go to those would be, I think, somewhat dictated in where you're coming from and where you're going to afterwards. I think for the most part, people who would be traveling to Turkmenistan, if you're going to go all that way, you're not going to be going only to Turkmenistan. And so it's going to be part of a larger trip that either involves the other stands and or Iran.
Now, were you doing this trip independently or as part of a tour, or how did you arrange this?
This was part of a tour. I think as a practical matter, it is very unlikely that somebody is going to get a visa to Turkmenistan on their own. It is very hard to get into Turkmenistan. And so unless you're going with a company that does a lot of tour packages there where they take care of getting the visa process and they dot all the I's and cross all the T's, I think for all intents and purposes, it's almost impossible to get in there unless you would have friends or family member who live in the country.
Well, and one thing we should bring up, just because people are going to look at the map and some people are going to say no right away because of its neighbors, because we just to the south of Turkmenistan or Afghanistan in Iran, Iran being a very stable country right now, although not always one that my country, the U.S., is friendly with, but Afghanistan not necessarily being as stable. But Turkmenistan, you found to be a fairly safe and interesting country to travel to.
Yes, and we went there from Iran, and they were quite different, but I felt safe in both places for different reasons, sort of at other ends of the spectrum.
Well, and we'll talk about more about Iran some other day. There's a couple very fascinating episodes that we've done on Iran that have made me want to get there ever since we've talked about it. So Turkmenistan, you started us in the capital.
Yes. Yeah. So Ashgabat, you would either fly into or conceivably, if you were on a road trip from either northern Iran or from Uzbekistan, you might come into Ashgabat via a car. But I think most likely you would come into the airport, which is very interesting airport. You probably will not see too many, if any, other airports that look the same, with a multi-billion-dollar airport that looks like a giant falcon. Like the shape of the airport terminal itself is a falcon, hundreds of feet, maybe thousands of feet across.
I will give you that. I think that is not something that I can come up with some other place that looks like that. Interesting. And a lot of the money that has gone into the country and refurbishing the airport and things like that is through oil, I'm guessing, from what you were saying earlier.
Yeah, it's. I think technically it's the natural gas. They have the fourth largest reserve of natural gas in the world behind Qatar, Russia, and I think Iran is the other one. So they have a ton of money selling natural gas, and they have used a lot of that in the last 20 to 30 years post-Soviet era to really redesign, among other things, the capital city of Ashgabat.
And what are we going to do in Ashgabat?
A couple things. One is to take a look at all of the new items. So there are quite a bit of interesting buildings, just interesting shapes and sites. It would be somewhat similar to going to Las Vegas and seeing the Eiffel Tower and the Luxor and all the other interesting buildings and hotels you see in Las Vegas. There's similar buildings that are one-of-a-kind type structures that are dotted all around the Archibald area, but it's the newer area, Archibald area of Ashgabat. There's a giant TV tower that's got a revolving restaurant 29 stories up and a giant turquoise star in the middle of the tower. There's an entertainment center with the largest enclosed Ferris wheel. I'm assuming that's to shield people from the summer heat. There's an independence monument. It's got a giant flagpole with gold statues and lots of big grand plazas. There's a monument, Arch of Neutrality, which vaguely looks like a rocket ship. They call it the tripod because it's got three legs that tether it to the ground. It was to commemorate the country's declaration of neutrality. It has a gold statue of the former president at top. The central bank is a shimmering blue glass building with sort of white wrapping that curves around it, a giant gold coin on top. There's a hotel that looks like a sail. There's a meteorological tower that's a kind of a rocket crossed with a thermometer. And then most interesting is the wedding palace, which is a place where you can go to get married and register your wedding. And it looks like a disco ball enclosed by a gyroscope, like something that you put the astronauts in during their training. Okay. And it's up on a hill, and so you can see it from a number of different areas around Archibald. And yeah, all of these buildings, like if any one of them would look amazing.
I've been in one of those astronaut training things, and you're right. That is exactly what this looks like. Wow, that's interesting.
So in addition to all of those, There is also some interesting museums. There's a historical museum, archaeological museum in that same area of town that has a giant flagpole that used to be the world's largest. It has inside it the world's largest carpet, which I believe still is the world's largest, and a number of historical items from various areas, from Parthian times and other historical eras of Turkmenistan. And when you're in there, you have to get a separate guide, separate from whatever guide you're with, to take you around, and they explain the historical significance of everything you're looking at. One thing that really stood out to us were these curved drinking vessels that kind of are in the shape of a horn. And they have these very intricate designs that will have animal shapes or animal crossed with, I don't know, dragon. Maybe dragon's not the right word, but probably the easiest thing is to just look up Rhyton, R-H-Y-T-O-N, on Google Images and get an idea of what these things look like, because they are quite interesting, and I didn't recall having seen anything like them on any of the other places we've traveled around the globe.
Interesting. Well, and you talked about this place being having a Parthian history. We should say that the name itself, the name of all of the stands, is not in any way complicated. It's the land of.
Right.
So the land of the Turkish people, the land of the Kazakhs, the land of the Uzbeks, that all of those are. So I'm assuming from the name that most of the people in Turkmenistan are Turkic.
They are, yes. So the history there, going well back to before BC, was part of the Achaemenid Empire of Persia, the Cyrus the Great, Darius the Great, that part. And Turkmenistan was northern edge of that empire. And then, as you mentioned earlier, Alexander the Great came in and conquered them around maybe 300 BC.
Yes. Yeah.
And Alexander actually came into Merv in Turkmenistan as part of that same trip, I guess. And at that point, it became part of a Hellenistic empire. And then Turkmenistan more or less was going back between Persian and Central Asian empires for quite a while, until the Turkmen people came in from
the steppes.
Pronounce this right? Oghuz tribes that moved in from Mongolia, and that was around the eighth century AD, and that built up what they called the Seljuk Empire, and that was really sort of the height of Turkmenistan's influence and power. So somewhere between, let's say, the year 900 and the year 1400, that was kind of the peak of its
history.
And
that was. That became a Muslim empire.
Yeah. Yeah, the country is quite full of Turkmen, although in some of the northern cities, there's quite a bit more ethnic Russian people. Noticed a distinct difference, and our guide commented how, especially the city of Dashaguz in the northern part of the country, right near the Uzbek border, there is quite a bit more ethnic Russians in that part of the country.
Okay. But I was just thinking, when you were talking about the carpet, we do associate carpets with Persian rugs and with Turkish carpets and such, and that sort of tradition goes quite far back in this particular area.
Yes, for sure. So that archaeological museum is quite interesting, and I was mentioning that the Rhytons came from Parthian times, and just west of Ashgabat, maybe only 15-20 minute drive, is the old Parthian city of Nisa. And it was a Parthian settlement built around 200 BC. And indeed, it was actually the capital of the Parthian Empire for a bit. So there was an imperial residence that supposedly was in Nisa. And most of the city was destroyed by an earthquake shortly before the year zero and wasn't really ever rebuilt. But what's interesting about it is, because it has been left alone for so long, even though it's in ruins, it hasn't been built over or looted to the extent that a number of other old Parthian cities have been. And so you can just walk around these ruins and walk right up to the walls. And it takes a bit of imagination to imagine what the city would have looked like. But it is interesting compared to some places where you're always behind ropes and you're 6 feet away from all the walls and you can't really get up close and personal. Here in Nisa, you definitely could.
Interesting. And it is a UNESCO World Heritage Site, we should say.
Yes, I think there's three in the country, and I think I will mention all three.
Okay. Excellent. Where after Nisa?
So in that same area, in fact, on the drive probably between Ashgabat proper and Nisa, there you'll go through the desert, but on both sides of you, you'll see mile after mile after mile of Christmas trees. And okay. These have all been planted purposefully in the middle of the desert, trying to change the climate to have more humidity, hoping to get more rain so that the climate becomes less oppressive. And I found that fascinating. I've never seen a country go to that effort to try and change their climate for the better. And it's really amazing driving through the desert and seeing Christmas trees on both sides. It's not something I was expecting to see. Also, the grapevines are in that area. And again, Turkmenistan is not an area that I would have thought of for grapevines. But if you look at their latitude, it's the same latitude as Italy, Spain, south of France, Northern California. So it certainly stands to reason that the grapes there could be a very high quality. What our guide told us is that the grapes theoretically do have high quality, but Turkmenistan is well behind the curve in terms of people being experts at fermenting, casking, bottling, etc. So perhaps 20 years from now, there may be a renaissance of Turkmen wines. Who knows?
Well, and that will depend a little bit on, you know, it's 93-94% Islamic, so it depends a little bit on what version of Islam they have through that period of time, how strict they are.
Yes, and that was something that was interesting. We noticed in Turkmenistan, as well as the other stands, that I think, if I had to guess, because of the fact that they were under the Soviet Empire for so long, the Islam in Central Asia appeared to us to be more secular. In other words, it was people's way of life, but it wasn't a formal government structure or anything like that. And there weren't any prohibitions against drinking alcohol or anything like that.
Interesting.
Another thing in the Ashgabat area that would be interesting is the Jipjak Mosque, which is one of the largest, if not the largest, mosque in Central Asia. And it was built maybe 30 years or so by the first Turkmenistan president post-Soviet era. And one thing that's interesting about this particular mosque, besides its scale, is that inside the mosque, in addition to quotes and scriptures from the Quran, there are also writings from the Runama, which was a religious text that was actually written by the first president of the country. And that has rubbed some people the wrong way, but you know, that's something you're not going to see elsewhere. Hmm. And to go back to something you mentioned a minute ago about depending on what sort of religion there is the next 20 years there, one thing that we were told that was kind of interesting is that Turkmenistan has government, quote unquote, supervision for religions. They basically interview people who want to open up a church, open up a mosque, open up a temple, etc. And they interview these people in the hopes of...
ButcherBox is sponsoring this episode of Amateur Traveler, and I just got my first ButcherBox. I've got packed with dry ice came 4 packets of ground beef, 3 packets of chicken breasts, 2 steaks, some pork ribs, and some sirloin tips. Now, I've got a great recipe for what to do with the chicken. At least one of those packets of chicken is going to become Greek chicken and rice. And if you go to chris2x.com, I've got a recipe there that's an Instant Pot recipe. But I'm not good with steak, and so I'm going to take advantage of the fact that ButcherBox has recipes on their site at butcherbox.com to learn some great recipes to do with those steaks. You can have ButcherBox deliver meat to your doorstep. Free shipping as always, curated to custom box plans. You can easily find high-quality meat and seafood you can trust. 100% grass beef, free-range organic chicken, pork-raised crate-free, and wild-caught seafood. Humanely raised, no antibiotics or added hormones. I also like the fact that I could recycle all the box and shipping material that they sent. Sign up at butcherbox.com/traveler and get our special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free for a year offer plus an additional 20% off. Choose salmon, chicken, breast, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/traveler. If you got recipes for ribs or steaks, send them my way, as I send my thanks to ButcherBox.com for sponsoring this episode of Amateur Traveler.
Making sure that they're weeding out any extremists that might try to take religion in a way that the government doesn't think is appropriate for its citizens. Hmm. Now, that could just be the way they explained it, and there's something more nefarious. I have no idea. But
could be both, yes.
Yes, could be both, yeah.
Yeah, interesting.
One thing I should mention about, since on the topic of that mosque, but it applies to several places in and around Ashgabat, is there, for people who are photographers, just be aware that there's a number of areas in and around Ashgabat where photos are not allowed.
Okay.
Either because they're government buildings or religious institutions or something like that. In fact, we were told we couldn't take pictures of the airport itself. We wanted to get pictures of the Falcon building, but okay. We were told no pictures on that. So one thing to be aware of when you're there is to just always make sure that you ask your guide if the thing that you want to take pictures of is, if that's allowable.
Well, and I've run into that in Western countries too. I've run into that in Victoria Station. Taking pictures was considered a faux pas because of security reasons.
Yeah, I've noticed that actually in some cities, and more often than not, it was because the thing that we couldn't take pictures of was the U.S. Embassy in some other
sure.
capital.
Yeah, interesting. Where to next?
So I would say next would be the gas crater in Durbaza.
Okay.
So that is about a 3-hour drive north of Ashgabat through the middle of the Karakoram Desert, which is one of the driest deserts in the world. There's not a whole lot to see on that drive, but there are a fair number of camels. And if you're lucky, you might see some foxes. We saw some for fleeting moments. But yeah, this is, I would say, the highlight of the country. And ironically, it's owed to a industrial accident 50 years ago.
Huh.
Like we mentioned earlier, Turkmenistan has some of the largest reserves of natural gas. And in the early 1970s, the Soviets, I guess this was during Soviet times, and Turkmenistan was one of the socialist republics within the USSR, they were drilling for a new reserve in Durbaza. And what had happened, what people's best guess of how this happened was, during Soviet times, there was a lot of cotton that was grown in Turkmenistan. And so there was a lot of rerouting of rivers and groundwater to feed all of the cotton that was now being grown on a much larger scale. And what they theorize happened is all that water diversion caused the water table to drop. And when the drill went through the soil and hit what should have been groundwater, instead it hit a bunch of air and everything collapsed. And so this crater collapsed in on itself. And like I said, it's about 300 feet across and 100 feet deep. And it's a little unclear as to how it caught fire. There are some people who say that the incident itself caused an explosion and just lit the natural gas on fire. And there's other people who say that once the crater collapsed and gas was being released, the scientists say, hey, rather than have this gas be floating around all over the country and going into nearby cities, why don't we just burn it off? But either way, this has been burning constantly for 50 years now. And so it just looks like a giant flaming crater, I guess, because it is a giant flaming crater.
That's probably a good reason for that.
The trip to Durbaza, as best we could tell, is almost always a 2-day, 1-night trip, coming either from Ashgabat or coming from Konya or Genç, which is about the same distance from Durbaza, but in the other direction, north. So if, let's say, you were coming from Uzbekistan and visited Konya or Genç in the morning, you would drive to Durbaza in the afternoon. Or what we did is we left Ashgabat a little after lunch and drove to Durbaza in the afternoon. And you get there just a little bit before the sun goes down. They explain to you on the drive the history going on behind this. And then you basically just hang out on the rim of the crater as the sun goes down. And then at some point you get your dinner and you sleep in a tent overnight. And then the next morning you go back and you check out the crater again, and then you're on your way. So it's not a long trip there, but it is definitely memorable because, with the possible exception of what you mentioned in Azerbaijan, this is something you don't really see anywhere else. And compared to, let's say, a volcanic crater, which might look vaguely right. similar, mm-hmm. there's not noxious gases, you know, sulfur that's going to come out and potentially ruin your lungs. So you can walk right up to the edge. There's no ropes. There is no barriers of any sort. And we asked our guide, hey, has anyone ever fallen in? And he said, no, nobody has. So I don't know. It's been all adults that have been there and people have been on their best behavior. Maybe there's something to be said for not having the barriers and forcing everyone to be reasonable with themselves. The one thing they did tell us is don't get closer than 3 feet from the edge because this is all very
unstable,
unstable ground, and you don't want to fall in because if you fall in, I don't see any way that somebody could get out. The walls go down quite steeply.
Huh. Well, and if you want to do a tour of flaming craters, Azerbaijan is just the other side of the Caspian Sea from Turkmenistan. So, you know, you're right there.
Yes. That was one of the things that they told us about as we were on the drive to Darbaza, which is people have quite a bit of interest in all the natural gas Turkmenistan has. And for the longest time, since it was part of the Soviet Union, all of the pipelines for the natural gas obviously went into Russia and then spread out from there.
Sure.
And now that Turkmenistan is an independent country, there has been quite a bit of interest in running pipelines across the Caspian Sea to transfer natural gas from Turkmenistan to Europe, bypassing Russia, basically cutting out the middleman, and a lot of geopolitics that go into that. And in the same way, there's pipelines that now go to China from Turkmenistan via, I think it's Kazakhstan, again, bypassing Russia. So it's kind of interesting to see how everything is reorienting itself decades after the breakup of the Soviet Union.
Interesting. Where to next?
Yeah, so from there, we traveled north on that same road that kind of goes straight up the center of the country. And just before the Uzbek border, there is the old ruins of Konya Urgench, which was from the Seljuk times, or the height of the Silk Road. And this was a area that rose to prominence between the 10th and 14th centuries, and for a brief time was capital of what is referred to as the Khwarezm area, where that was a khanate, that was a kingdom, if you will, that had areas in what present day is Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, and Turkmenistan. Some of the cities in Uzbekistan, such as Kiva and Samarkand and Bukhara, were part of this same area. And the podcast on Uzbekistan is great. I would definitely recommend people listen to that podcast as well. We used it a lot to actually plan our trip for the one we went on to Turkmenistan in Uzbekistan. But anyway, as with many of the areas in that Central Asia time in the 1200s, Genghis Khan came and wreaked havoc. He destroyed Konya Urgench in 1221, but the city was rebuilt. And then they were conquered about 150 years later by Timur, who was a Central Asian general and king. And they surrendered to him to have the city be spared, and he did spare it. But apparently shortly thereafter, they rebelled against his leadership, and that was not taken too well. So the city was burned to the ground, all the irrigation was destroyed, and crops were planted on top of the remains of the city.
Huh.
After the city was burned to the ground by Timur, it lost influence to Kiva, which is like I said, a nearby area just on the other side of the border in present day Uzbekistan. And after that happened, Konya Urgench was abandoned. So again, it's one of those things where it's not in great shape, but since it was entirely abandoned, it is more or less exactly how it was hundreds of years ago. And so it's interesting to see what it looks like now, because unlike a lot of areas that maybe have been rebuilt to show what they look like 1,000 years ago, this has not been. So you just see the state of disrepair. So you can get an idea of what it once was, but how it has been for 800 years now. There's four main things to see in Konya Urgench. One is a giant minaret about 200 feet high called the Kutlug Timur Minaret. And apparently the minarets were built so high back in the day so that people on the Silk Road could get an idea of, oh, okay, that looks about a day out. That looks about 2 days out. You would actually see where you were going from town to town. Also in that area is a Turabek Khanum mausoleum that we were able to go inside. The inside is in pretty good shape. The inner dome, when you're on the inside, you can see the
mosaic,
all of the decorations and the mosaics. Mm-hmm. But when once you go on the outside, you can see that the outer dome, which sits above the inner dome, is about half gone. And one thing that's interesting about that is so many of these domed buildings, you never really realize that there's actually two domes, an inner dome and an outer dome. Mm-hmm. But this one you can see clear as day, and you can get an idea of how these buildings were actually put together. Also in the same area, there's the Tekesh Mausoleum, which is a little bit smaller than the Turabek Khanum Mausoleum, but has a more intact roof. And you can see a lot of the blue tiles that are specific to the Seljuk era and the architecture during that time.
Ah, okay. Because I'm thinking they reminded me a lot of some of the buildings we saw in the episode on Uzbekistan, but that would also probably have been Seljuk Turk then.
Yes. Yeah. And even frankly, during that time, some of the buildings we saw in Iran had the same architecture, because I guess during that time, the Seljuk Empire had either power or influence over some of Iran. So it was interesting to see the same architecture in what today are three different countries. But back 1,000 years ago, we're all sharing culture and architecture and everything among themselves. The fourth thing that was really interesting to see in Kunyurginch was the caravanserai. This is an area where you would, as you came into town, you would place your camels and other animals in this area, tie them up, and then go into town and go to the market and whatnot. And a lot of these caravanserais you don't really see anymore, but this one is in pretty good shape still. So that was interesting to see. So yeah, Kunyurginch is probably about a half day tour, but pretty interesting.
Well, and the caravanserai is basically the heart of the Silk Road, right? You're basically traveling from one to another along this route. It was your chance to resupply and take care of the camels and such in a relatively safe place.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so a lot of these cities, obviously, they went to great lengths to make sure that it was safe for people, because if you had an unsafe city, people would have just found a different route, gone to a different city instead. So there was quite a bit of competition to have the best markets, the most secure facilities, so on and so forth. So then the last place I would recommend people see, which is out in the eastern part of the country, is Merv, which was one of the biggest cities that you've never heard of. Apparently, around 1100, it was the third largest city in the world, with over 500,000 people.
Huh.
And this goes back to 3rd century BC times. Like I mentioned earlier, Alexander the Great actually visited Merv as part of his exploits out in Central Asia. The city was actually named Alexandria for a bit, and the city lasted for hundreds, thousands of years, but really started to grow in influence and power when the Oghuz Turks, aka the Seljuks, peacefully took over around 1037. And so between then and when one of Genghis Khan's sons destroyed the city in the 1200s, it was, like I said, one of the largest cities in the world because of its specific strategic place on the Silk Road between the mountains that separate Turkmenistan from Afghanistan, and then also the desert to the north. Merv was kind of in the sweet spot in between them. And so people coming down from Samarkand and China and working their way towards Iran would almost certainly go through Merv.
Huh.
But the reason you haven't heard of it is it was sacked by Genghis Khan's son, Tolui, and of that, more than 500,000 people, all but 400 people were killed.
Oh, my gosh.
He spared 400 artists, but everyone else was killed. And as you can imagine, after that, it took the city a long time to recover, and it lost all of its influence and power. And really, it was a shell of its former self until it was eventually captured by the Russians during the 1800s. But what's really fascinating about Merv is because it's been around for so long, it has seen power and influence in multiple different eras. And every new era, rather than build over what was already there, they would just build a new walled city just to the side of where the old walled city was. So it's kind of like seeing history side by side by side. There are an area called Erkala, which is 7th century BC from the Achaemenid Empire. Right next to that is Gyarkala, which is from the 3rd century BC, sort of the Hellenistic Parthian era. Then there's Sultankala, which is from the Seljuk times, and obviously that is in the best condition, but it's fascinating to see kind of oldest, older, and old side by side by side. And there's quite a few interesting things to see there, mostly in the Sultankala area. There is a tomb of Ahmed Sanjar, who was one of the most revered leaders during that time, that was built in the 12th century. That one has been restored, so it's in much better condition than some of the other things even right next door. And in fact, we were talking a minute ago about how during this time, you might see similar things in Uzbekistan. The tomb of Ahmed Sanjar really reminds me of the Samani mausoleum that's in Bukhara, and also one of the buildings at the Jami Mosque in Isfahan in Iran. And I'm assuming that they all use the styling that was the sort of the in thing in the mid 12th century. So it's, like I said, it's interesting to see a lot of the same styles being used over and over again in what now are different countries, but then were very related to one another. There's also what they call the Great Kizkala, which is this, it almost looks like a fortress. It's outside the city walls, so it's a little unclear exactly what it is. Like maybe it was a guard tower or something to that effect. But the what's interesting about it is the walls are corrugated. So if you could imagine doing diagonal tiles and not filling in all the missing triangles, that's what the walls look like. They're constantly jutting in and out.
Huh.
And I don't know if that was for defensive purposes or just because it looks cool, but it does look cool. And a lot of that is still intact, maybe 75% or so. And these walls are about 125 feet across and 40 feet high. This is a square-shaped building, and that's another one of the highlights to see in Merv. And Erkala, the oldest, a bunch of mud walls that obviously 2,700 years later are not in great shape. But you can walk up the walls because through erosion, it's basically just not that steep an incline anymore. But you can walk up to the top of the walls and get a good view over the city. And again, you need a fair amount of imagination to imagine what the city looked like 2,700 years ago, but you can definitely make out the perimeter and you get an idea of this, if nothing else, the scope of the city. And you can see the neighboring newer parts of the city as well. So that's pretty interesting.
Well, and you were talking about during the time of the Seljuks, and I don't know if we quite put a time frame on that, but we're talking about the late 1000s into the 1100s or 1200s or so would be the newer part of the city.
Right. Yeah. So the Oghuz people came from the Mongolian steppes, I think, like you said, the middle of the 11th century. And I would say that period more or less ended on your specific city, depending on whether it got destroyed by one of Genghis Khan's people or whether it got destroyed by Timur or both.
Yeah. That's why the when it ends is always easier for historians to put a date on, but it's sometimes not as clean in actual history when this empire starts or when it ends. Excellent. Well, and those were the main sites that you wanted to cover, if I recall correctly.
That is, yes. And so, again, I know normally on this podcast, people are doing 1 week and 2 week trips. And I think, frankly, for Turkmenistan, you're more on the 4 or 5 days, and you combine it, like I said, with Iran and or Uzbekistan as part of the same trip. There are land borders to go between the countries. And so depending on where you come in, you might end up in Merv first just because it happens to be closer to where you're coming from. And so, yeah, those are the four main sites. But I would say that Turkmenistan is not going to be an area where you're going to be hanging out for 2 or 3 weeks by itself.
Well, and I double checked in the 2000... 2022 trip that we're looking at for Amateur Traveler, it does not go to Turkmenistan. It's Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and then Samarkand in Uzbekistan. So maybe this is the trip that you add on to that when you come with me.
So. Yes, it is an easy add-on, particularly if you're working with a company that has the ability to get the necessary visas for Turkmenistan. One thing that I don't think I mentioned earlier is this may be one of the least visited countries in the world. There are more people who go to Antarctica every year than Turkmenistan. There's something on the order of 7,000 tourists a year.
Huh.
So if you average that out, it's only about 20 a day.
Now, who did you use to facilitate your trip?
We used MIR, M-I-R.
Okay.
If you ever read any of the travel magazines and they've got all the ads at the back, going to Peru and Galapagos and New Zealand and everywhere else, if you see something that's got Central Asian buildings on it, the odds are pretty good. You've seen an ad for MIR, and they really did take care of everything, and they did right by us. I know there's a handful of other companies that go there as well, but I certainly have no reason to not recommend MIR.
Is that MIR like the
M-I-R.
Space station? Or okay.
Yep, exactly like the
Is
space
that a
station.
Russian company from the name?
I don't know. I was dealing with somebody in Seattle, so
okay.
I don't know.
Or do where, they specialize in Russia or something?
They definitely, their bread and butter is Central Asia. That is their thing. That's what they do.
Got it. What else should somebody know before they go to Turkmenistan? What do you wish you had known before you went?
Well, I think one thing that I wish I had known was that the picture taking was going to be a little bit more difficult in some places.
Okay.
Another thing also dealing with pictures is in Turkmenistan, as well as a lot of other places we saw in Central Asia, there's maybe an entry fee to the site that you're seeing and then a separate fee if you're going to take pictures.
Okay.
So to give an example, it might cost $5 to get into Nisa, but another $5 if you wanted to take pictures.
Sure.
And that's a thing where you just need to have maybe a little bit of walking cash around to cover things like that. And a lot of them are by camera. So if you have, let's say, a long lens and a short lens, you might have to pay twice for the camera fee.
Now, did they charge for people with cell phones? Because I haven't seen people catch up to realize that almost everybody has a camera in their pocket.
I honestly don't remember off the top of my head.
Okay.
We were just using cameras. And so maybe they just assumed that if we had actual cameras, why would we be taking pictures with our cell phones as
right.
well? The answer being, of course, the panorama feature, but they didn't know that. One other thing to bear in mind, also camera related, is because of the size of Darvaza, the gas crater, you're probably going to want as wide an angle camera as possible so that you can get it all in. A lot of the pictures I took have 90% of the width of the crater, but not all of it.
Okay.
And so if you had something more like a 16mm or 18mm width on your camera, you could definitely get it all in. My wife's GoPro was able to get photos that fit it all in. And another thing at Darvaza related to pictures is I had lugged a giant tripod all across Central Asia to take nighttime photos of the crater. And once I was there and had set up the tripod, I realized it's way easier to just take handheld photos because there's so much light coming out from all the flames.
Huh.
You don't actually need the tripod for the long exposure. And indeed, the longer exposure time, the pictures just look blurrier because the flames are moving around.
Oh, sure.
So, yeah, just take a normal handheld camera and that you don't need any specialized equipment to take photos of the gas crater even at night.
And by the way, the answer to the question about MIR and their whether they were formed to do tours to Russia, the answer is yes. They were the name, I did it correctly identify as Russian. It means both peace and world, hence the MIR space station. And it basically, the person who founded the company in 1986 basically helped organize a goodwill volleyball tour to the USSR and then formed this company again at that time to help people go to the Soviet Union.
Oh, okay. Well, that all makes sense.
Yeah. So we sometimes ask this question, I think this is an appropriate time. When did it feel most like home and when did it feel the furthest from home?
Most like home, I would say, was one of the days in Ashgabat.
Mm-hmm.
We were at just a small local restaurant, fast food restaurant in one of the Russian bazaars. And this is sort of the equivalent of going to like McDonald's or KFC or something like that. And in there, it was a bunch of young people probably on their lunch break, and they were all on their cell phones, and music videos were playing on a TV that was in the corner of the restaurant. And it seemed so different from everything we had just seen earlier that morning, and definitely seemed like something that you could see in any small restaurant anywhere in the U.S. So that was where I would say it seemed the most similar. The least similar, I would say, maybe at one of the border crossings. We did a land border crossing going from Dashaguz into Uzbekistan, and we went on to Kiva as the first stop. And there, you definitely realize that you're doing a land border crossing from one foreign country into another foreign country and everything that goes into that. And especially in an area where English is not widely spoken at all, and you're trying to communicate via pointing to various things in the passport and pointing to various things on these forms, you definitely realize that you're a long way from home.
Well, and sometimes in those land borders, it doesn't feel like you're being greeted as a long-lost friend so much as a, why would you come here and what are your motivations? And it's not always welcoming. I don't know what your experience there was.
Yeah, it wasn't the warmest.
I generally don't hire people for that personality trait, I think, in around the world.
Yeah, well, it's also one of those things, too, when you get only 7,000 people a year.
Exactly.
You're not really meeting the tourists. There's not really a giant incentive to be outwardly friendly to them. Mm-hmm. They're just doing their job. One thing I will say, we had been told this prior to packing, is that they check your bags when you get in for, I don't know exactly what they're looking for, but one of the things they're looking for is any illicit drugs, and included among that is Sudafed, I guess, because maybe you could make something from the ephedrine in it.
Okay.
So if somebody was planning to take cold medicine with them, which is a good idea, just don't take something with ephedrine in it.
Okay. Anything else we need to know before we get to Turkmenistan?
I would just say the food was a welcome surprise. This was the first of the stands that we visited. And so this was our first experience dealing with Central Asian food, because we hadn't been to Central Asia before and you don't see a whole lot of Central Asian restaurants in and around the United States. Mm-hmm. The food was amazing. It really is sort of a mishmash between Chinese food to the east and Mediterranean, Turkish, Greek type food to the west. And it's really, really good. Some of the things we had were borek, which is a dumpling soup that was quite good. Manti, which is kind of like a giant pot sticker, large dumplings. Lagman, which is a pasta, but also in a soup. Lagman is a noodle that has a diameter roughly of, like, let's say, a pencil. So okay. They'll have pasta dishes that might have like lamb and spices and sauce on the top. Or you might see lagman in a soup with, let's say, chicken broth. And so all the food there was quite amazing. Actually, some of the best meals we've ever had anywhere at just quick and easy restaurants in and around the towns there.
And you were in a small group tour?
Yes. So we had actually booked a tour that was private.
Oh, okay.
We would have been fine with other people coming.
Yeah.
But it was one of those, like, look, we want to go on these dates and see these places. And no one else was interested in doing the exact itinerary we did. But yeah, a lot of these tours to that part of the world are your 10 to 14 day package tour that sees some Merv and maybe Samarkand and Bukhara in Uzbekistan, and maybe one of the other stands or two of the other stands as well. And they have longer trips that will hit all five. And there's a lot of those that we saw as we went around. We saw some of the group tours in Kiva that were maybe 20 to 30 people. Hmm. And you would see those going around some of the sites. But it didn't seem to be that much more to do a custom tour, maybe just because there's not that many tourists in that part of the world.
Sure.
And they're just happy to have people who are interested to see what they have to see there.
Well, one of the reasons I asked was related to the food, because I've found that, you know, when you do the smaller group tour, even like we've done with 11 people, 12 people, even up to 16, you can go into a local restaurant and you might fit. When you start to get into 30 to 40, your options get much more limited. And so I've found the food isn't necessarily as good because you can't go to the small local restaurant. You have to go to the specific place that can deal with when you're in a big bus. So
that's a good point, because we did have one of the meals in Dashagoos at a place that obviously, if you've gone to on these group tours before, you kind of know the group tour restaurant that's got the giant tables for 16, 20 people. And like you said, the food is not as good there. There's not as many choices, but it was still good even there. It was just not as good as some of the places that we were able to go that were smaller.
Excellent. And what time of year would you recommend we go?
I would definitely recommend either the spring or the fall, depending on what other places you're going in conjunction. Definitely not the summer, because it would be excruciatingly hot, and not the winter, because especially if you're going to go to the gas crater and you'd be out in the middle of nowhere overnight in a tent, I think it would be far too cold. So I would say either the spring or the fall. If you're going somewhere, let's say like Kyrgyzstan, where you might want to do some hiking, I would recommend the fall, because you're going to have better weather there. Maybe September would be great. If you were combining Turkmenistan with, let's say, Iran, I would recommend the spring, so that some of the spring colors and flowers in and around Shiraz and Isfahan would be in bloom, and the rivers in those cities would have more water. But definitely the spring or the fall would be my recommendations for the time of year.
Excellent. As we start to wrap this up, you are standing in the prettiest spot in Turkmenistan. Where are you standing and what are you looking at?
You are standing on the east side of the Darbaza gas crater, looking across the crater at the sunset to the west.
Excellent. One thing that makes you laugh and say only in Turkmenistan.
I would say it was our border crossing, because there was a little mix-up with some of the stamps on my wife's passport. And they ushered her back to go back across the little walkway that goes between Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan. And we had no idea what was going on, and we were a little freaked out at the time. But now that time has passed, it's now a funny story that we can chuckle about.
All right. And that's doing it with a guide.
Yes, although the guides, we had separate guides for each country. So in that little area, we were separated from the guides. The other thing that I would say only in Turkmenistan was we were lucky enough, I guess I would say, to get rained on in the Karakum Desert. We've actually been rained on in that desert and in Atacama. So I don't know. That probably puts us among fairly select company. But one thing
I've been in a thunderstorm in the Sahara. Does that count?
Yeah, that definitely
on camels with other listeners of the show. So
wow. But one thing that was fascinating, because of the rain coming down in the middle of the desert, is there were camels all over the road drinking water out of the potholes.
Sure.
Because it was the one spot where the water was actually pooling rather than just sinking down in the sand.
Right.
So only in Turkmenistan have we seen camels drinking water out of potholes.
Excellent. And if you had to summarize Turkmenistan in three words, what three words would you use?
Truly, undeniably foreign.
Okay. Now you're going to have to explain that.
We have visited, we've been lucky enough to visit over 50 countries now. And of all the ones we visited, Turkmenistan is the one that seemed the most foreign to us in terms of how everything was laid out, in terms of how structured it was, in terms of how different everything seemed from what you're used to traveling, not only in the U.S., but even, let's say, in Europe or South America. This place just seemed the most different from any of the countries that we've seen. And this really does sort of epitomize every sense of the meaning of the word foreign.
Excellent. Our guest again has been Justin Barnes from justinandcrystal.com. And Justin, if we wanted to send people, do you have a post on Turkmenistan that talks more about your trip?
Yes, we have a travel log for that whole trip. that visited Iran and Turkey and four of the five stands, and it's got some pictures and some video, and I think it would give people a pretty good idea of what you'll see there and what to expect, and hopefully some people will find it useful.
Excellent. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. And thanks so much, Justin, for coming on and sharing with us your love for Turkmenistan.
Happy to do it.
In news of the community, first, a thank you goes out to the patrons of the show who help support Amateur Traveler, especially to those who joined me for a Zoom call last week. It's always fun getting together. You also can support the show if you're interested by going to patreon.com/amateurtraveler. I did also want to put out an apology to Debbie, and Debbie, you know who you are, who I accidentally, while she was trying to join the trip group, the amateurtraveler.com/trips, which is a private Facebook group where we talk about where we're going to go as a group, I accidentally deleted her when I was trying to approve her because I shouldn't do that thing first thing in the morning. But if you're interested in joining us on a trip, once we can start traveling again, amateurtraveler.com/trips. Thanks for Philip, who commented on the episode we did recently on the Carretera Austral in Chile. This was a terrific listen with an articulate and very interesting guest to whetted the appetite to visit. Would have been useful to hear more on accommodation options, budget, particularly in such an interesting region. And thanks for the feedback, Philip. I'll try and keep that in mind in the future. I've been highlighting some affiliates that we work with at Amateur Traveler here at amateurtraveler.com/affiliates. The one I want to highlight for today is Urban Adventures. And Urban Adventures does day tours. And I'm surprised that there are still a number of day tours that are happening now, and possibly one in the city you're in if you're getting just a little tired of being indoors. They're still trying to practice safe social distancing and masks and all of that sort of thing, but you might check them out. Go to amateurtraveler.com/affiliates for a link to that. And with that, we're going to end this episode of Amateur Traveler. If you have a question, send an email to host@amateurtraveler.com, or better yet, leave a comment on this episode at amateurtraveler.com. And thanks so much for listening.